It is Locked On NBA Thursday edition. I'm David Locke. Hope you're loving the five-day-a-week edition, the bite-size synopsis of the night that was, the day that will be, and a big story going on. Today, Thursday editions will be in interviews. Last week, you had the great interview with Brent Barry. This week, Dallas Maverick radio voice Chuck Cooperstein. First, I'll run through last night's action, and then Chuck will join us. It is Locked On NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Chuck Cooperstein will join us here in just a second. Let me quickly run through some of the big action last night that took place for you, so we stay with us and know you'll get this every single time you tune into Locked On NBA. Adam Matas and Anthony Irwin tomorrow for you will have even more detail. The big one last night, New Orleans winning in San Antonio, 121-116. New Orleans now has big wins over Cleveland and San Antonio on the road that were probably not expected. They are rolling and really putting themselves into terrific playoff position. San Antonio is vulnerable if you look at their schedule. It is not a guarantee that they are a playoff team at this point. Defense last night was optional. The Pelicans offense had an offensive rating of 120 in that ball game. It's not totally stunning that this is taking place. If you look back before the injury, when Anthony Davis was on the floor without DeMarcus Cousins, the Pelicans were +7 per 100 possessions. When he and DeMarcus were on the floor together, they were +4.2, which was great. But when DeMarcus was on the floor by himself, they were -2. So now you're taking 37 minutes a night of Anthony Davis on the floor without DeMarcus Cousins, and you're getting that +7. And what they have done is they've been about even in the non-Anthony Davis minutes. Last night, they were even at 11. So that, to me, is really what has happened there. It's that some of this is they're winning a ton of unnaturally close games right now, but they also have gotten rid of their negative. Elsewhere last night, Houston continues to roll. They blew out the Clippers early. Clippers coming on that off that emotional win in Denver the night before, just weren't ready to go. Oklahoma City wins in Dallas. They are staying alive and dodging bullets. The Oklahoma City Thunder have won last-second games against both Sacramento and Dallas recently. They have that nice win against the Warriors, but if you scan back now over the last, since the Andre Robertson injury, this Thunder team loses to the Wizards on January 30th. They were 10 games above 500 on that day. Since then, their wins are that great win against the Warriors. Then their wins are 2 against Memphis, 1 against Sacramento, 1 against Orlando, and 1 against Dallas. And they have lost to the Lakers twice in that standpoint and been on the ropes. They are not playing great basketball. They have won 5 of their last, now 6 of their last 13. But those are the wins that they have. That has still not clicked in like everybody thought it was going to, though their schedule is not difficult. Their playoff positioning is solid. Milwaukee, worn out from their game the night before, loses to Detroit last night. Detroit is 6-0 since Blake Griffin joined them on back when their other team is playing a back end of a back-to-back. Worth noting that Milwaukee is now in the 7th spot, just a game above Miami. Miami's 3 games above Detroit, so it's going to be a tough road for Detroit to make it back into that playoff picture. But Milwaukee, can you imagine Boston or Toronto getting Milwaukee in the first round of the playoffs? I'm not sure that's a matchup that you want. Elsewhere last night in the NBA, not a lot of big surprises other than Atlanta of the Tank Fest beating Indiana 107-102. A little bit of a surprise there, particularly just the way things have been going with those bottom-level teams seemingly not trying to win games, though Atlanta has won 4 of their last 10. That's getting a little tighter. Indiana is sitting at 5, a game and a half back of Washington for that home court advantage and possibly slipping. Washington fell last night against Golden State, 109-101. Third quarter again, Golden State wins that third quarter, 27-14. Boston's offense exploded in Charlotte. They scored 67 points in the second half of that game, 134 for the whole night. So it was just no defense played early and often in that game. So that's kind of the quick wrap-up of what happened last night around the NBA. Now let's welcome in our guest, Chuck Cooperstein. Well, Chuck, let's start it off with where your game last night, great one, Thunder and the Mavericks. I just talked about the Thunder and how they're just sneaking by. I mean, they're just barely staying alive, to their credit. Why do you think that hasn't clicked?
I think Carmelo's gotten old. You know, I just it happens. And, his game as a post-up player, just doesn't fit in. And as a high-usage guy, doesn't fit in with the two other guys who are also high-usage guys and are probably better than he is at this point in his career. And yet he's still getting a lot of minutes. He's obviously not the same player that he was, certainly 5 years ago when he was in New York and he was a really good player. I still have, I always have my doubts, as it relates to Westbrook and just, how good he can be to lead his team deep into the playoffs. I know I'm in a minority when it comes to him, but, the turnovers are just way too much. The casualness of his play, and handling the ball is way too much. He doesn't guard anybody. He made some big shots last night in overtime for sure after Dennis Smith had really gotten the Mavericks off and rolling. But I just don't see the mix on this team. They have no bench. They've got no wing shooting really to speak of. That's been a bugaboo of theirs for years. And I see an early exit for them in the playoffs.
It's interesting you talk about Westbrook because I am such an efficiency-based guy and I've got my offensive rating system called PAC. He's one of the 10 most negatively impactful offensive players in the NBA this year on his possessions. Like, he's way off his regular, what he was a year ago.
Well, he's shooting okay. His percentage overall is okay, with 43%. That is generally where he's been in his career. But his three-point shooting is terrible, at 29%. His shot selection is just awful. And to me, again, that just goes back to basketball IQ. I mean, he's such a great athlete that he just allows that to carry him, and on most nights, that can carry him a really long way. I just don't think it can carry you a very long way in April and May.
I'm so curious to watch what happens if Paul George switches teams next year, because we've got the sample size now of like 9 guys who, when they leave the Thunder, they get better. And the other one on the Thunder...
I'll tell you what.
Go ahead.
I'll tell you what, though, David. Paul George has been great. I mean, he's had a great year. He's done everything that you would ever have asked him to do in that trade. I mean, he's shooting 42% from three. He guards like crazy. Made a great closeout last night on Dennis Smith to end the game. You know, he leads the league in steals, and granted, that's not the ultimate defensive statistic by any stretch. But I think he's been great. And, I mean, I don't know. I don't think it really matters if he plays with Westbrook at Oklahoma City or he goes someplace else. He's a great player. I mean, he is absolutely a top 15 player in this league.
It took him a while to figure it out, right? He's been brilliant since January 1st, middle of December. His first 20 games, I thought, were a little rocky. I don't think he could figure out how to play in that setting. And since middle of December, I could probably try to find, when and how and where. And for all we know, there's some story behind it that the crew there has covered. That took place. I mean, it's almost like he misses those 2 games early in December and he just comes back a different player. But that's where he's turned.
Yeah, I can remember a game that the Mavericks played against him in mid-November where he and Westbrook just went nuts in the third quarter of that game. In fact, they scored by themselves more points than the Mavericks scored in the entire quarter. They each had 16 in the quarter, and I think he had like a 37-point game. That was on top of the 42-point game he had against the Clippers like right before then. I mean, I think he's really been good, and I think he's had some awful shooting games. He had the 1-of-14 against Golden State. He had the 1-of-12 against the Mavericks back in late November. But I mean, he does everything on the floor. I just can't imagine why you would not want him on your team. And I think you can win with him. I think you can win.
It's funny how play-by-play announcers are. My reference point is we played him December 23rd, and he had a great game, and I've watched him since December 23rd, Paul George, 25 points, 6 rebounds, 3 assists, 48% from the field, 44% from 3. So you're absolutely right.
I think you can win with that, David. Yeah. I think you can win with that.
Yeah, I think so. All right, Houston Rockets blow out the Clippers again last night. We saw them just recently. The win they had against us was impressive. They had, were missing 3 guys. It was a back end of a back-to-back. It was a grit and grind win. It was the kind of win you don't think that a Mike D'Antoni team gets. How much of a threat do you buy the Rockets as?
I think they are a threat. I really do. I mean, Harden and Paul, I mean, this is like watching, frankly, and I may be dating some people here because I'm old enough to remember it because I grew up with it. This is like watching Walt Frazier and Earl Monroe play together with the Knicks, where, you know, Monroe came to New York and really had to, change his game in order to fit in with Frazier because they both needed the ball in their hands. But yet they both managed to find a way to get the ball in their hands enough that they could be brilliant. And I think that's just been the case with Harden and Paul together. Their numbers are such that, they're not always playing together. But when they do play together, it seems like there's just an innate sense of who's really got it going. And they just do such a fantastic job of playing off of each other. And frankly, both of them are such excellent pick and roll players. And that has led to Clint Capella's ascension as an elite center and a guy who certainly is going to get paid in the offseason. He's very much Capella, the X factor for the Rockets, because there are very few people that have very few teams that have centers who are as athletic. And when Capella sets that high screen and then he rolls, simply have the foot speed to be able to stay with him and then have the jumping ability to try to jump with him when they throw it up to the rim and he finishes.
Absolutely. Interesting perspective from you because you're not in the race. The playoffs in the Western Conference are insane. Basically, Houston and Golden State are in. With the Jimmy Butler injury, I think Minnesota's in, but it's not set. Who are the two teams in your mind that don't make it at this point? If you have to guess, what two teams are not making the playoffs in the Western Conference of the Houston, San Antonio, New Orleans, who's on fire, 7 straight, Blazers, who've won 4 straight, Thunder, Nuggets, Clippers, Jazz?
I have a feeling it's going to be Denver and Utah. But I'm not totally sold on the Clippers, although that win over Denver the other night was ridiculous. The arrival of Boban Marjanovic, who really can play. You know, it's really so bizarre. We saw him in San Antonio and have some really good games against the Mavericks. He goes to Detroit and Stan Van Gundy buries him. He gets traded in the Blake Griffin trade, and he's kind of buried. But he's always been able to shoot the ball. He's got really good fundamentals. And not to say that you're going to play him 25 minutes a game. That's ridiculous. But I don't see why you can't play him 15 minutes a game and make his size batter you and make you pay for having him on the floor. Listen, I'm a dinosaur when it comes to this kind of stuff, David. I believe in the big man, in the classic big man. I believe in playing as big as you can possibly play, as opposed to playing as small as you can possibly play, as so many teams want to do. I think that guy has value. But somehow I think Doc Rivers has been able to keep this thing together with baling wire and chewing gum. He's done a fantastic job. And I just have a feeling they're going to sneak in. And I'm not sure that Denver and Utah are going to quite have enough, although I'm really impressed with Utah and the rally that they've made here. And we obviously saw them the other night. And just, Mitchell has a sense about him, even though he's my money, too much of a volume shooter. He takes too many shots, doesn't shoot a good enough percentage. But Joe Ingles, I just love him. Absolutely love watching guys who know how to play. And he really knows how to play.
Wild card in this conversation, by the way, is San Antonio. They're not all the way in. They have a 3-game
lead.
No, they're
not all the way in. But you can't say that they're out until they're actually out. How can you really go against them at least being in the top 8, even if they're clearly not the team that they've been? Where you looked at them as significant contenders, they could. Listen, they get in, they can lose in the first round just as easily as anybody else can.
Yeah, no, this
and they're a real bad. And the other thing about them, They better get home court advantage because they're a bad road team. They are a terrible road team. And that's just not going to stand well for them if they're not a top four seed.
Great points by Chuck Cooperstein here on Locked On NBA. Let's move the conversation over to the Eastern Conference. Who walks off with the one seed, and who's your favorite?
Toronto and Toronto. I think this is the year. The Cavaliers remind me of the 2011 Los Angeles Lakers, where they've been in the finals three straight years. They have star player that's played who knows how many minutes and has had so much placed on him that while I think the trades that they made at the deadline probably helped them as much as from the addition by subtraction standpoint, and I do think that George Hill and Rodney Hood are really going to help them, and Larry Nance Jr. too, and Clarkson. Toronto is just so well balanced, and frankly, you could make the argument that they were the second best team in the Eastern Conference last year. The only difference was that instead of playing in the conference finals against the Cavaliers, they had to play him in the second round. I love what Dwayne Casey has done. And again, in a lot of ways, they remind me of the 2011 Mavericks, that it's a team that's been growing and growing and growing. They've had their disappointments, but it's about time for them to make the big jump forward. And sure, they've got their issues like everybody else in the East has their issues. But the one thing, David, I do believe in them more than anything else, they have an incredible home court advantage. I mean, it is one of the most underrated, I think, home court advantages in the NBA. We don't see Toronto on TV very much. ESPN, TNT don't put them on very much. But having been there, and I know having been there for a number of years now, that place is crazy. That is Golden State good. And I think it's going to be a heck of a team that walks in there and beats them twice in Toronto in a seven-game series.
It's worth noting on them, their differential, which everyone says is the right way to look at a team more than win-loss, as you look at someone's differential. And we talk about how the Rockets are this threat and incredible. The Rockets' differential is 8.9. The Raptors' differential is 8.7.
And, I think some of it has to do still with the difference between West and East. The East is better this year than it's been, but the West is still a better conference. It's still deeper. I mean, even the bad teams in the West, like the Mavericks, are still incredibly competitive as opposed to the teams in the East, which quite frankly are not. So the fact that that Toronto has that number is probably – it's still probably taken with a little bit of a grain of salt, but I just don't think people don't want to believe in Toronto. I think, David, because they haven't seen them. They just haven't seen them play very much. But just unless you watch them on League Pass, or unless you're like you and me and we get to go all over and see them play in person, you really don't know that much about them. And I think that's where the narrative comes from.
Okay, I'm going to give you where my narrative comes from. My concern on them. So two things. One, I actually am. Was really, I've said this before on this show, I really was disappointed that they did not add something at the trade deadline. I love where they are. I think they're the best team in the East. Their bench unit, as great as it is as a regular season unit, sincerely concerns me in the postseason. The concern on the Raptors, the legitimate thing you can bite on the Raptors, when it gets close this year, they're awful. They're the 25th ranked offense and the 23rd ranked defense in clutch time this year. They are overall, for a team that has the second best differential in the NBA, they have the fifth worst differential in games that are within 5 minutes with 5 minutes left. It seems too easy to say this, but there's two problems here that I see. One, they revert back to everything they did that was wrong the last few years. And two, and maybe this solves itself in the playoffs, they don't have any idea what their closing five is. They don't know if Valanciunas, is it Ibaka small? They just don't know, and it's not the same night in and night out, and they've been the only teams worse than them in clutch time this year are the Clippers, Hawks, Magic, and Mavericks.
Well, I'm just curious now because I'm not looking at the number. How many games have they actually played in those situations? Because their point differential is so good.
28.
As compared.
28. Which is a little less than average. The
Right.
So that's 20. They've played the 20. It's a great question. They've played the 24th most amount of games in clutch play. But they're going to be in clutch play probably five or six out of seven.
You figure that they should be. Yeah, the longer they go in the playoffs, that they should be. Look, you know, guys like Lowry and DeRozan, it's time for them to play a heck of a lot better than they played in the playoffs. And I just think that the experience, having gone through all of those experiences, that they will play better. I think your point about not making a trade is really interesting because, you know, I look at our guy here in Dallas coming off the bench, J.J. Barea, who's just having a monstrous season, fantastic season, leading the NBA in assists off the bench, assist to turnover ratio of 3.31 to 1. Over 4.5 here in the month of February. He's just been incredible. And obviously, he's got playoff chops. And with all due respect to somebody like Fred VanVleet, if you're trying to win it, and really you've got a two-year window, which they basically decided on when they re-signed both Lowry and Ibaka in the offseason, you've got to go for it. And I just can't imagine that they wouldn't have tried to get a player like J.J. Barea or someone of that ilk, a real veteran, experienced point guard that has some playoff skins on the wall.
We traded Rodney Hood. I don't know that they would have been willing to do this, but I want with the Jazz, DeLon Wright for Rodney Hood worked numbers-wise.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe they're not.
Yeah, no. But I still think it's you know, they still need it. They need a point guard. They need a point guard, I think, to really just be able to orchestrate things and keep things together when things get crazy in the playoffs, which you know they will. But I just really like their team. I mean, having said all that, I love that they're big and physical and nasty. And frankly, look, you know, you get to the playoffs, and even though we're in a scoring era, the game still slows down. I realize Golden State and Cleveland didn't quite play that way in the finals last year, oftentimes. But the times that Golden State did get to that point, Cleveland never did. But Golden State certainly did. And when they did, they won. And I still think that that counts for something. And that's where Toronto, with their ability to score, which sets them apart from a team like Boston, which other than Kyrie Irving is really struggling to score the ball, and allows Toronto to go farther than anybody else, I think, in the East this year.
The one note, just so everybody has full understanding, when I use those clutch numbers, Chuck brought up a great note about sample size. I would point out the best offensive teams in clutch this year: Houston, Cleveland, Boston, Miami, Golden State, Milwaukee, Minnesota. So generally the best offensive teams are near the top. The defensive numbers are a little wackier. Charlotte, Sacramento, of all weird things, Memphis, Indiana, that's a little wackier. Final Eastern Conference question for you. I think we're pretty well set that the top four teams are Toronto, Boston, Cleveland, Washington, which we knew. Actually, let me ask you a Washington question.
I don't know about that, Dave. I mean, you know, Cleveland, I think, their lead, I mean, Indiana lost last night.
Right.
That's a bad loss to Atlanta.
Really bad,
I mean, just a horrific, horrific loss. But, I mean, they're still, I think, two games out of third with 20 to go. And the Cavaliers have not convinced me, despite – you know, the hosannas from the media that say it's a different time in Cleveland, that they have it all together, that they're going to be able to, you know, to hold on to a three spot or maybe even a four spot. I mean, I still think that 3 through 7 in the East is very much in play. Very much, you know, it's not as good as from a quality of play standpoint as it is in the West. Because really, I mean, if you look at Washington, Indiana, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and to a lesser extent Miami, which is going to be in, but is a little bit farther back. It's the same team. Aren't they the same team?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Pretty much like you're watching them play, and it's like I could just change this team, these guys and that guy, just change the uniforms, and I get the same result every time.
It's really interesting. Really interesting point. You're surprised Washington's better without John Wall?
A little bit, because I do like John Wall, although when we saw them in late January, the Mavericks held them to 75 points, and they were just a dysfunctional, disconsolate mess. And, you know, it may very well be that in one of those deals where John Wall, for all of his goodness, is a guy that is really hard to play with. And guys don't like to play with him, even though he's a He's an assist guy. He's average, you know, a 10 assist guy, and he's certainly willing to give up the ball, and he plays fast. But it's just a really, his body language from night to night is usually the determining factor in whether or not the Wizards are going to be in it and interested in playing or not. Clearly that they've not had him. Satoransky's done a really nice job. Brazier's done a really nice job coming off the bench. You know, Oubre's been great coming off the bench. I mean, he's really stepped up here in his third season. But I still can't trust that team. Just like I can't trust Indiana, losing to the Mavericks and Atlanta back-to-back, and I can't trust Milwaukee. I can't trust any of those teams in the East right now.
Great points by Chuck Cooperstein. All right, next we play Commissioner of the NBA. Chuck,
I love this.
If you were commissioner, what are one or two major changes you make?
Well, I mean, I would first off institute the Zarin wheel for the draft and just end the concept of tanking entirely, because what's happening here, you have almost like a perfect bell curve this year where you've got Toronto and Boston in the East. You've got Golden State and Houston in the West. There, you know, you're on one end. You've got this big morass in the middle, and then you've got these eight teams that are all going like crazy to try to get to the bottom and, frankly, in many cases, embarrassing themselves. The Mavericks play the Bulls tomorrow night. I'm doing Bulls prep right now, and I'm seeing what Fred Hoiberg is doing, and obviously with John Paxson and Gar Foreman calling the shots. Oh, you're sitting Robin Lopez right now. You're sitting Justin Holiday, who's a young guy that you brought in and who's really playing well for you. Well, now that you're sitting him down, Jerian Grant isn't playing right now. You're playing Cameron Payne instead of him. It's like, you know, it's not like they've got such old players on their team, save for Robin Lopez, that that you've got to sit people out and try to find out, you know, whether they can play or not. It's really pretty embarrassing, actually. And it's embarrassing throughout the league. I mean, Memphis can't help itself because, you know, Conley got hurt. Now he's gone, whatever. And they've had a bunch of injuries. Parsons got hurt. I mean, they're a mess. Phoenix is just an absolute mess, period. Who knows what they're doing out there. But it's just a bad look. And I understand, you know, what's at stake in the draft this year, because there are too many big players, and you don't usually find a grouping of bigs that potentially can have the impact that this group can. And everybody wants to make sure they get at least one of them, whether it's DeAndre Ayton or Marvin Bagley or, Mo Bamba, Wendell Carter, whoever it is. It's just not a really good look for the league when you're asking people to spend money and those people are expecting a full product. It may be one thing if it's April the 3rd, but when it's March the 1st, and you're doing that already, that's just not a really good look for the league. And I think the wheel winds up eliminating that, because everybody knows where they're going to draft.
For those who don't know what the Zarin wheel is, it's done by an executive at Boston, and it eliminates everyone over a certain period of time, gets the same draft picks within a realm, and it eliminates draft based on that season's record. It's terrifying to smaller market teams that can't play the free agent game is the problem with it, in that you lose a mechanism by which to build your roster. And so I think it's very nerve-wracking. I will say this, though. I have not been one who thinks tanking's a problem. I actually think it's a micro versus macro issue, that if you're tanking, you're actually trying to get better longer, and most fan bases are willing to deal with it. However, with the gambling thing coming and with everything you just talked about, I do feel like it's hit a breaking point this year. And if I was in a room of people for the last 10 years, I would have argued it's a non-issue that's been created by the media. And this year, I would sit in the corner quietly. I think it's crossed over. So I that's always how I kind of – that's always feel about things. Like, if I was in the room of decision makers, what would I argue? And up until this year, I would have just said, stop. ESPN's created this. Tom Haberstroh and his guys have talked about it. And it's become – when he was at ESPN, it's become a bigger issue than it is. But right now, it does feel like something's changed. I don't think the new system – I think the bigger problem they have is that the new system isn't going to change it at all.
No, in fact, you might even have more people do it, because at least – you know, the top three are absolutely guaranteed the same chance, or the bottom three, depending on your point of view, are guaranteed the same chance of getting number one. So you might have more people try to tank and get themselves in the lottery, and then hope the ping pong balls fall their way. It's It's just a really bad look, I think, for a league that, generally speaking, night to night puts out an incredible product. Yes. It just really takes away from it. And I'm just one that I don't want my – I want my fans to know that I'm trying to win every night. I'm doing the best I can. And if I win, I win. If I lose, I lose. And you know what? I'm a great believer. You respect the game, and the game respects you back. And tanking does not respect the game. Not even close to it.
All right, I've got my one. I want your thought on it. I've got a bunch of them, but we'll do a longer podcast in this offseason.
Why?
So I go to 32 teams. Probably, I don't, you know, I know they want to do Mexico City. If they can figure that out, then they can do it. But, you know, either Seattle, Vancouver, or Seattle, Kansas City, Seattle, Louisville, something. But with 32 teams,
right.
It allows me to do two primary things that I'd want to do. One is I go to eight divisions, and the eight division winners make the playoffs, and then the next best eight teams.
That's not bad, except, again, you know, anytime you spread things out that just – you run the risk of having a really bad division, have a team qualify for the playoffs, yep, and automatically qualify, even if they, you know, might not have the record that allows them to. And that's the downside to that. But I see where you're coming. I didn't think you were going there. I was thinking you were just going to play like, you know, four 18 divisions and play the majority of your games within those divisions and then try to, you know, figure it out from
I'm actually
elsewhere.
Going the opposite. I actually want to get rid of the conferences, and then you play, even if you do it with six, if you just decide to have six divisions, which wouldn't be equal, so you have to have either four or eight. I think it's a trap too bad that Dirk Nowitzki plays his entire career in Dallas and the fans in New York could only see him once a year. I think, as everyone talks about how much travel is a problem, we also are so good at it now that I think we should get rid of conferences and almost move pods the way the NFL does, so that, excuse me, Dirk goes to Philadelphia twice one year, New York twice a year, and those years maybe he only goes to L.A. once, but we spread the talent out wider so fans can see him and the schedule gets equalized a little bit rather than having Eastern and Western conferences.
Something to be said for that. I won't deny that. You know, especially in Dirk's case, he loves playing in the Garden more than any place else. So any additional trips to New York would have been really, really good for him in his career if we were using your system.
And by the way, my final one is, as much as I don't like soccer, I'm adding, I think we got to rebuild rivalries. So those eight divisions then at some point in the season, I actually think maybe internationally, start the year in little conference or division cups. So you can win the division cup to start the year. And I actually would send all eight divisions to a foreign land to start the year. We start the year overseas, somebody in Japan, somebody in China, somebody in Spain, somebody in Paris, somebody in Australia. And then we come back for a mini training camp again and start the season.
You're really thinking big. Adam Silver, I think, would like the way you think. I don't think the teams would like it so much, but I do think that seeing the big picture and where the NBA is, and you know, knowing that they're playing preseason games in China every year, and they play a regular season game in both London and Mexico, and I think they're going to go to India next year in the preseason. You know, they've got big plans for this, and you know they've got the sport to make it work. I think you know the whole idea about you know internal cups and things like that, which obviously exist in soccer, it's just such an anathema to the American sports fan. I don't think they know how to process all of that. And I think that's something that could, I mean, I guess you'd have to do it and you'd have to keep beating people over the head to tell people, hey, this is important, so that they wind up believing that it's important. But until then, you know, how do they wrap their arms around that? Why is it more important for them to, or as important to win that cup as it is to win the NBA Finals, or certainly even get to the NBA Finals.
Yeah, we like to win. I think if you give us anything to say we're going to win, then fans feel good about winning. People like to win.
Well, and teams certainly want to be able to put banners up in their buildings. And this would give them more opportunity to be able to do that.
Chuck Cooperstein, I love it. Now I'm going to send in my request to have Adam Silver on this podcast, and we'll do a longer commissioner version in the off season. Thanks for your time. Your opinions are always awesome. I appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you coming up here sometime.
March 22nd. March 22nd you will be in beautiful Dallas, Texas.
All right, we'll do Shake Shack or something for lunch. Talk to you soon.
No, we'll do a lot better than Shake Shack.